Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. I have saved all my ribbons for thee.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Tim Bernal with BernalofAmerica.com, Bernal of America Audio. It's the month of June. This month we're going to be rolling out four parts of the press conference, the X-Conference 2 press conference at the National Press Club. I was there. I had to change my flight. I had to grab a crazy ride in to the city of Washington, D.C., went by the monument, went by the White House. It was awesome. Thanks to Robert Miles, who loaned me a wire to hook up the MP3 recorder to capture the press conference for everyone here. Yes, that's right, I was a member of the press, and now I'm bringing the news and the scoop back to the BernalofAmerica.com visitors and the Bernal of America audio listeners. The press conference, part one, kicks off with Steve Bassett. He was the organizer and director of the X Conference, so it's only fitting that he kicked it off. He's the founder of Paradigm Research Group, executive director of the Extraterrestrial Phenomena Political Action Committee, the XPPAC. He's the author of the Paradigm Clock website. He's made numerous TV and radio appearances. He ran for Congress in the District of Maryland in 2002, and is the only registered UFO ET lobbyist. So he's knee-deep, elbow-deep, if you will, in the disclosure movement. And that's why he kicked off the press conference. This is part one of four, Steve Bassett opening up the press conference. It was recorded on April 25th, 2005. Let's take it away.
Okay, good morning. My name is Stephen Bassett. I'm the Executive Director of Paradigm Research Group. And I'm here to make some announcements and some assertions. And I'm going to go first. I have a colleague here who also has an announcement to make. But I think it'd be more appropriate if I do mine first, and then I think his will be a little easier to get your mind around. We have additional individuals here today who are here because they may be involved in answering some of the questions, right? I'd like to introduce them. From my left, outside, is Dr. Robert Wood, Dr. Michael Sala. Here's Dr. Alfred Weber, historian Richard Dolan, researcher Grant Cameron, and Dr. Bruce McAbee. I'm here to announce that the second annual Exopolitics Expo, X Conference 2005, was concluded on Sunday, April 24th. This event was produced by Paradigm Research Group. 26 speakers and panelists presented to 450 attendees over 3 days. It was a unique event which focuses on the political, governmental, and social implications of extraterrestrial-related phenomena. It is produced by PRG as part of the emerging activist movement seeking to end a government-imposed truth embargo regarding extraterrestrial-related phenomena. The keynote address was given on April 23 by retired Monsignor Corrado Baducci, who spoke in the United States for the first time regarding the religious implications of extraterrestrial beings. Balducci is the highest-ranking Catholic official to publicly speak to the question of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. His views arose from his personal research and did not represent an official position of the Holy See. Nevertheless, they have drawn much interest and debate worldwide. During that evening, the second annual PRG awards were issued, and these are as listed. For political courage, President James Earl Carter, Jr. For courage in journalism, Jaime Musson of Mexico. For Courage and Journalism, Billy Cox, currently of the Florida Today newspaper, Gannett chain. Hall of Fame, living recipient, Walt Andrus Jr., founder and 30-year international director of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, and Hall of Fame deceased, Dr. James E. McDonald, a very well-known meteorologist and scientist in the 50s and 60s, who was one of the first scientists to truly push the issue scientifically against great resistance. And the Disclosure Award went to Monsignor Carlo Abaducci. For perspective, the awards last year went in this manner. For political courage, the award went to Congressman Stephen Schiff for his efforts to secure records from the Roswell events of 1947 on behalf of his constituents, right, which he pursued with some vigor and great frustration, which he denoted publicly too long before he died. Courage in Journalism went to Sarah McClendon. Sarah McClendon was a close friend. The room upstairs next to the Reliable Source restaurant is the McClendon Room. One of the reasons is that room is that Sarah McClendon was one of the most fierce, independent, unviable, uncooptable journalists Washington has seen in a long time. She did nothing for money. She did it all simply for the truth. She was unique, but that's a bad thing. We need many, many of her walking around with press passes today. I'm looking, I'm not seeing. The Courage in, Hall of Fame Living Award went to Stanton Friedman, 35-year researcher based in Canada. And the Hall of Fame Deceased Award went to Dr. J. Allen Hynek, astronomer who was the leading scientist of Project Blue Book until he, after considerable effort and time and deliberation, realized that Project Blue Book was a propaganda front for the government. He turned his position and opened and founded CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, which he pursued until his death in 1986. And the Disclosure Award went to Philip Corso, career Army intelligence officer who worked at the highest levels of government, including on the Security Council of Eisenhower, and for Senator Eastman, and Senator Thurmond, and many other positions. It was a strong MIA advocate and appeared on the Hill many, many times. In his later years, he decided to reveal some things he had done, particularly with respect to Roswell. He wrote a book called The Day After Roswell. He talked about the transfer of technology. He talked about being in charge of the records. He talked about seeing a dead alien. He was then ignored pretty much by the Washington Post and anybody else in this town, and by the Army and the Air Force, though the book sold vociferously in the Defense Department bookstore. And when he died, the Washington Post did not see fit to do an obituary. So you kind of see the pattern of these awards and why we're giving them. They are intended to honor individuals who have demonstrated courage, perseverance, and commitment to the pursuit of truth, particularly as applied to facts known and withheld regarding extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. The Paradigm Research Group calls upon all those who have held or who aspire to leadership of this nation to match these qualities. That's why they give these awards. In particular, it calls upon Presidents Carter and President Clinton and Senator Hillary Clinton to fully discuss their experiences with this issue. And it calls upon former White House Chief of Staff and presidential aide John Podesta to put this issue of extraterrestrial engagement front and center of the agenda of the Center for American Progress, a think tank, which is heavily backed by George Soros, a powerful advocate for open government. Now, those of you that are saying, I beg your pardon, who are you calling upon? Before I get to Alfred Weber and then on to questions, all right, President Jimmy Carter brought up the issue, was inundated with mail, and initiated two studies in the very first month of his presidency. One was initiated from within the executive, brought in Marcia Schiff, went off in one direction, and the other was initiated from outside from Stanford Research Institute, and that was led by Alfred Weber, who was very, I think, surprised when he got a green light after approaching the White House and went back to SRI planning an extraterrestrial phenomena study under Jimmy Carter. What happened next was that the government, how would you say, in pact, all right, in situ, moved to stop Carter immediately. Part of the, one of the group that did that was George Bush, also the head of NASA, and other agencies basically told him to go pound sand. Then the Defense Department sent out a liaison person to the SRI to meet with Alfred Weber and his boss, and that person said that if SRI continues this incipient study, they're finished with DOD funding. And that was that. Alfred was encouraged to go along. He did not. Shortly after that began a year and years of harassment and intimidation, which eventually forced him to leave the country. We know this because we have a firsthand witness to it, Mr. Weber, who's with us today. Mr. Carter eventually stepped from this issue and never returned again. All right. I can imagine what he went through. He's the only person on a federal ballot, or at least had been the only person on a federal ballot in November, to talk about this issue in the history of the nation until I was able to get on a ballot in a congressional race in 2002. So he beat me by 26 years, that rascal. And he took a great deal of criticism. What happened very shortly after he made these, or allowed these initiatives to go forward. By the way, the first initiative eventually brought in a gentleman by the name of Danny Sheehan, who was an activist attorney, Jesuit attorney. He eventually, in the process of winding down the program, he sort of wanted to sort of do a formal winding down, he eventually was able to see some documentation. In fact, they brought in the Blue Book documentation. It's kind of an appeasement thing as I saw it. But interestingly, the documentation includes some classified stuff that normally was not seen, and he saw some extraordinary material, including very powerful photographs of crashed vehicles with military people around it. He could not take that material, but he did trace some of the designs, some of the calligraphy off the side of it on a back of a cardboard, and walked away with that, for which I'm sure he is faced with some consequence in the afterlife. He gave it to the Jesuit that he worked with, and it has been kept somewhat, how would you say, secure since then. He started to speak out about this after many years. Shortly after Jimmy Carter did these studies, he was attacked on multiple levels. Key people in his administration were undermined and forced out, and were young. He was associated with scandals back in the state where he came from, the southern rural state, particularly financial scandals involving close associates like banker Burt Lance. He came under attack as being a liar, many other things. It was, I recall, a rather particularly nasty attack in the sense that it was out of character. He was an extraordinary man. He was one of the probably most truthful men that ever set foot in the White House, though I don't know the founders that well. He is still an extraordinary man, and they really went after him. It is my contention that an untold story of the Carter administration is that a significant reason why these attacks attempted to get him out after one term was not because they didn't like his southern drawl, or because they didn't like his teeth, or they didn't like his wife or his mother, but because it was absolutely unacceptable in 1977 that a Democratic president during the Cold War would approach the issue of extraterrestrials and any kind of truth embargo and bring information to the public at that time. And any president that attempted to do that, particularly Democratic, had to go. Which brings us to President Clinton. We know President Clinton engaged the issue significantly because he talked about it a great deal and because we have substantial records of the approach of Lawrence Rockefeller to the Clinton administration via the Office of Science and Technology Policy very early in the administration. Lawrence Rockefeller was a billionaire. They sold his condo for $30 million after he died. Penthouse condo, I should say. But he's also an advanced thinker, interested in things other than stocks and bonds. And so he was a little outside the box, but you returned his calls. And he approached John Gibbons of the Office of Science and Technology Policy through his attorney, Diamond, Henry Diamond, and said he wanted to meet with Clinton, and essentially, if you read the documents, he wanted to meet with him so that he could become the disclosure president. And he did it in a very polite way, very civil way. They were going to do this by the books, and And as you read the material, you see that. And they were, you know, not in a hurry. And letters were exchanged, gifts were exchanged, promises were made, meetings were held, researchers were brought in. We have some of them here. Reports were written up. All right. Sitting off to the side of this engagement in OSTP was his one of his key aides, John Podesta, who I am absolutely certain, though I can't be fully certain since his records are not accessible yet, what OSTPs were, because it was an exempt from the FOI from the restricted law that would have kept it out of FOIA. I'm almost certain that John Podesta knew that something was going on at OSTP. I'm almost certain that Hillary Clinton knew that as well. All right. We also know that in the documents that the concept of releasing information about UFOs and about extraterrestrials was heavily discussed, and eventually there was an executive director order that substantially loosened up the classification schema and dumped a lot of documents out. Podesta was put in charge, and he takes credit for it today. So John Podesta knew about the initiative in the first months of the administration regarding Rockefeller, who was very knowledgeable on the subject. We also know that President Clinton and Hillary Clinton went to Rockefeller's ranch with some regularity, and we are fairly certain that this material was discussed there. We also know that a number of researchers in this field went to meet with Rockefeller at his ranch to discuss how this would be approached, and that the outcomes of these meetings were then used in the interaction with John Gibbons and OSTP. Melvin Laird came involved. Sheila Wignall became involved, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth. Now, they were all dancing around the issue in some degree, but understand, there is this formal thing happening in Washington regarding this issue and a billionaire, and so they're dealing with it. We know this because we have the documents. These documents were in the office of OSTP. They by no means represent all the documents referring to this incident, or this episode, but these are what we could get. A number of people, including Dr. McAbee and Grant Cameron, FOIA'd the OSTP documents on certain keywords and received 900 pages of material, and in that was the record, at least from the OSTP perspective, of that initiative by Rockefeller, which lasted for about 3 years. I have a few samples of these. If a member of the press would like to review them, they're welcome to have them. We have more. And it's fairly certain that if the Clinton files, the Podesta files, can be accessed at the appropriate time, and if it were possible to get access to Rockefeller's personal records, which I think are being held fairly close, we may find a lot more documentation. The most intense portion of this occurred during the first few months of the Clinton administration. During that period, Clinton started to respond to this engagement, though not directly in the documents. We know this because one of his aides wrote a book called Friends in High Places in which he indicated that Clinton had asked him to go to Justice and look into the UFO question and ask around about that. And he went as far as to go to NORAD and ask around about that. Shortly after that, they started indicting Webster Hubble for everything, including sinking the Maine. During this period, the attacks against President Clinton began to build. They would eventually build to a crescendo that was probably as intense as anything anybody in the modern era had ever seen. In fact, many press in this town, and I recall reading these articles myself, press from both sides of the political persuasion would scratch their heads publicly and say, it's a partisan town, and mistakes have been made, but we don't understand why they're using a nuclear bomb on this person because he wrote on the wall with crayon. It just didn't make sense, and the money mounted, and it mounted, and it mounted, and it was absolutely relentless. They tried to tie Clinton to some scandals back in his home state, a southern state. They tried to tie him to some financial scandals involving some financial close ties that he had back in his state. And they made them as big and as bad as they could. And they tried to bring him down. I think it's fair to say, without any disrespect to President Carter, that President Clinton is perhaps a superior politician. And he did not lose the election, and he continued. Now, that point is important for this reason. I believe that there is an unwritten story that I invite the political media of Washington, D.C. to look into. It has two parts, right? Part one, the unspoken, unknown reason that explained why Clinton was assaulted by several hundred million dollars of attack to bring him down, in spite of the fact that he was shoveling money by the billions into the pockets of the wealthy in this country legitimately by creating a very fine economy and a lot of other nice things, was because of the extraterrestrial engagement by Rockefeller. That he, exactly like Carter, had raised extreme alarm bells in the NSA and the DIA and the CIA and other elements of government that would not allow or were not ready to have disclosure at that time, certainly under a Democratic president and certainly under one who was so disliked by members of the military and the intelligence community. So disliked that in the first months of the administration, letters had to go out to line officers in the Army to inform them that if they continued to insult the president in front of the troops during parade, they could be court-martialed. The second part of the story, which I think is Dr. Pulitzer written all over it, is that I am, and I can't prove this, but so what? You know, give me a newspaper, a couple of million dollars, and a new Ben Bradley, and maybe I could. I deeply suspect that a protocol, an unspoken protocol, that is part of the regiment in this town was broken. And it's a tough one, and it's the one American people don't know much about. And I'll describe it to you now. The protocol is this. Any person that gets within a stone's throw of the White House by the elective process, which you may recall doesn't require a security clearance or an oath up until the point that you put your hand on the Bible with the Chief Justice, is completely vetted by the intelligence community, and they build dossiers on that person. Right? Strom Thurmond, right? Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, anybody that gets close is dossiered. Just in case, there are things there which are so potentially dangerous to the welfare of the United States that it might be necessary to intervene. But of course, it would be extremely inappropriate to do that except under the most severe conditions. So those dossiers would absolutely remain private, right? Held by the intelligence community, which holds lots of dossiers, including some on you. You can count on it, right? I contend that it needs to be looked at as to whether elements of the intelligence community allowed parts of those dossiers to get in the hands of the right-wing attack of Clinton. And I would look first at Mellonscape, because they knew if there were mistresses, they knew where they live, they would know their numbers, they would know the times and the dates, they would know everything, because they have the ability to do that. And in the interest of national security, in the interest of addressing a problem that had arisen in the early days between the view of the president and the view of the military intelligence complex, maybe it would be time to break this protocol. And of course, he had the gall to ask Lester Hubble to look into this issue, and he's got his OSTP science director talking to Rockefeller, and Rockefeller's got $1 billion. And if Rockefeller wanted to, he could have run ads in every single newspaper in the country and Europe describing why he wanted to have disclosure. At any time, he could have done that. And there's nothing they could have done about it except kill him. So they had a real problem on their hands. By contention, they tried to bring the president down over the UFO ceiling the second time. Right? So, what's happened since? Well, what's happened since is rather interesting. Hillary Clinton has gone on to become senator. And she's clearly a contender for the presidency. And I am an independent, and I'm not speaking partisan here. I would strongly encourage the Republican Party to not underestimate the ability of Ms. Clinton to win the election next term. John Podesta went on to become many things. His brother built a substantial public relations firm. He was a consultant and a go-to person on a number of issues. A brilliant man, absolutely brilliant man. And he developed very strong, powerful ties and ultimately started building a think tank. Right? This is a process that takes some time. He had to eventually raise $25 million. This took several years. About halfway through this process, something interesting happened. The Sci-Fi Channel, the science fiction channel, had a series coming up called Taken, produced by Steven Spielberg, who had made $2 to $3 billion off of movies which directly address the extraterrestrial theme from a number of perspectives, including high realism in Contact and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I was approached by the Sci-Fi Channel to talk about the idea of adding an advocacy component to the marketing of the film. But a legitimate one, not a phony one, and I wouldn't have gotten involved with a phony one, and I talked with them for a number of months, and they went off and did some things, and that was fine. I was running for Congress at the time, an activist campaign. It wasn't intending to win. And eventually they did that. They formed an advocacy group looking to get information, looking to get the truth. It was set up, obviously, as a nonprofit outside of Sci-Fi Channel, but it was clearly backed by Sci-Fi Channel money, which was at that time owned by USA Networks, and I forget who's above that, but Barry Diller was in there somewhere. He's always in there somewhere. And let me tell you what they did. They created this advocacy group. They put a website up. They came into town to create a presence. And I thought they did a fabulous job. First of all, you got to have a public relations firm if you're going to push an issue around in this town. So they hired one. They hired Podesta Mattoon, partnered by Anthony Podesta, the brother of John Podesta. Okay. And they hired a K Street law firm, Lobens Novell, I think. I'm missing one of the partners. I'm not sorry. Convey my apologies. K Street, to represent them in the legal aspects, primarily FOIA filings. Right? So very sophisticated here. And they then held the press conference that you would do to announce this. And I attended that press conference. And I was a little surprised when the press conference was opened by John Podesta, who was not formally involved in CFI, but he clearly was being a spokesperson. And he came up, it might have been in this room, and he said a couple of things. And what he basically said was that he was for secrecy reform, that he had released a lot of documents in the early days of the Clinton administration, and that he felt the material with respect to UFOs, or whatever you want to call it, needs to get out there, and there's material there that needs to be gotten, and it was carefully but very, very clearly stated. And after 5 minutes, he left the podium, Bonnie Hammer and some others came up and talked, and the Coalition of Freedom of Information was launched. Wonderful. Pretty good. They spent a year doing some things. I'm not sure if they hit room temperature, but they did some things. They filed some FOIAs. They could make some documentaries. They had money. They had stuff that activists need, and it was great, and it was welcome. And the website, it's okay. And they did, and they went out, and they tried to get some information from NASA, information on the Kexburg case and some other things. Brian Gumbel was one of their documentary hosts. And then they had a second press conference, and this was exactly 1 year later, October 2003. And in that press conference, they came out basically to announce that they were not getting the information they wanted. They're about to launch a lawsuit against NASA, which is good. I like that. And they needed to start that press conference off. And so the person that started off was John Podesta, who came in and for 5 minutes basically said what he had said the year before, but with a little more, a little more pressure. You know, you need to get these documents out, and it's necessary, whatever. And these things are on file. You can go find them. They're on CFI's website, I believe. If they're not, you can go CFI and probably get a copy sent to you. And then he left, and they proceeded to talk about how they're going to file this lawsuit. Now, 3 days after this press conference, NASA released some documents to them. That was nice. 13 days after the press conference, John Podesta launched, after raising the $25 million, the Center for American Progress, a supposedly independent, nonpartisan think tank, right, with all the bells and whistles, fantastic website, the top people. It was quite a feat. $25 million was pledged, and a good chunk of that money came from George Soros. Now, that's notable. George Soros is a billionaire, controversial man, extremely aggressive politically, gave tens of millions of dollars to the Democratic Party, but where he really puts his money is he puts his money in the issue of open government. And he has funded open government organizations all around the world to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. So now George Soros has entered the picture. Right? What was most notable to me, however, and this is what the press need to consider and look at, is that in this period of 12 months, John Podesta, who was the White House Chief of Staff to Bill Clinton, who was engaged by Rockefeller on this issue and suffered tremendous attacks, was completely out of the closet on the extraterrestrial issue as a matter of releasing records, far advanced of Stephen Schiff. And he walked around this town untouched. absolutely untouched. It's probably John now. Just a second. I can't take that call. This is a town that eats its young, right? And if anything, it does it more ferociously in the last 4 or 5 years that I'm talking about. The campaigns were close, and a major Democratic operative tied to the Clintons was discussing bringing the truth forward about extraterrestrials, and nobody in this town was touching him. Furthermore, right, he was getting his usual presence on television on a range of issues, so he didn't talk about this one. Right? I found that very notable. Now, it could be that the right was afraid of George Soros' money. Don't ridicule Podesta. He's sharp. He's a razor. And I got $1 billion. You get on him, I'll get on somebody else. That could be. If I had George Soros behind me, I'd go in almost any bar in town. I don't know. All I want to know is, how can a former chief of staff of a president come out publicly for extraterrestrial release of documents on extraterrestrial phenomena and not be engaged by every network in town? Every network in town. That is a massive story. What is their protocol? What is their agenda? What is going on here? What is the editorial policy? What does it take for this issue to be engaged? All right? So, I'm going to close, and I'm going to introduce Alfred by this. Here's the way I see it. I have tremendous respect for Jimmy Carter, believe me. I think he's a great man. But greatness just simply doesn't stop. It goes on. And if he needs to consider this. He was deeply damaged and thwarted to pursue the truth when he was president. He knows about this issue. He was stopped. Lord knows what was said to him. Lord knows what it took to stop this man from going in that direction. I think he needs to come forward and talk about what happened then, talk about his personal views on this, and bring this issue into play. He has the moral authority, and if he does so, I believe his legacy and his greatness will only be enhanced. Which brings me to President Clinton. President Clinton is a complex man. He has many years ahead of him, and he has a complex life. Because he has a wife who may be the first woman president in history. I respect that. These are serious issues to consider. However, if you're the president of the United States, former or current, and you know or have information with respect to extraterrestrial presence, it's not enough to make jokes in Belfast or refer to it occasionally regarding Social Security. You have an obligation to come forward and talk to the American people. And if you know for a fact, and this is another story that needs to be pursued, that it has come to pass, for whatever reason, that Democratic presidents do not receive the same information from the national security structure on this and other issues as Republican presidents, you need to talk about that too. Whether or not it damages the potential future politically of your wife. And there's potential legacy here. Legacy that will transcend even what he has dealt with. And that brings me to John Podesta. Actually, no, it brings me to Mrs. Clinton. Be real clear. I'd be very happy to see a woman president, Democrat or Republican. And I can fully understand, and I know, in fact, that this is going on right now, that Mrs. Clinton is considering a whole range of modifications of her views as she contemplates the presidency. And a whole lot of things might be modified and changed in order to be president. Some of those things one could accept. However, no way can you aspire to be president of this country and be in the closet on the extraterrestrial issue, knowing and having talked with someone like Rockefeller, knowing of the initiative that was targeted your husband, knowing something is going on, but you're just going to put it on the back burner until you can get in the office, and then you'll do what? That's not going to work anymore. There are too many sharp people now. There are too many websites. There's too many books, too many information. Most of the people here are doctors. The rest of them could be doctors, PhDs. It isn't going to fly. I encourage Mrs. Clinton to consider that she needs to be not just the first woman president, if that's to be. She needs to be the first candidate for president of a party who says, this issue will be discussed in this campaign. I will insist upon it. And that last brings me to John Podesta. I'm impressed with him. He has a think tank. It's the best gig ever. He has the funding. He has the brilliance. He has the presence, and he has the charisma. And he wants his cake and eat it too. He wants to be able to go in front of the camera once every year and talk about how he released documents and how he feels that we should know the truth about this. But he won't put it in his think tank. He won't talk about it on the shows. He won't make an initiative. There'll be no white papers. Meaning, I did my gig, and when disclosure happens, we won't forget about me. That's not good enough. Might be good enough you just came out of, grassroots and you worked your way up. And you finally got something together, and now you're a player. But not when you worked at the top, not when you worked at the White House, not when you worked there when that initiative was underway. And, of course, you had the ability to influence. And let us not forget, least of all, John Podesta is one of the greatest X-File fans in the country. And for him to walk try to double-side this issue, I think is a disgrace to the memory of both Fox and Mulder. So I invite Mr. Podesta to come public on this. And last but not least, it would appear that George Soros does not lack gumption or money. He puts it where he wants to. He believes in open government. If he believes in open government, then he needs to fund the ending of this truth embargo. That's not a hard equation to figure out. Mr. Soros could end this embargo in probably 6 months. He has the money to do it. He doesn't have to do it through the Center for American Progress. He can pick another entity and do it, or he can do it by himself. Will it be dangerous? Perhaps. So what? These are the people that are involved with this issue in the public arena. And there are many more beneath them. I've encountered some of them that know, astronauts and scientists, who don't really have the leverage to come public and don't want to lose a career, and I don't blame them. This town is filled with people that know this issue is true, right? This town was filled with people that know a lot of things are true. And until we start acting on the things we know are true, this town's reputation for truth is going to continue to decline. And that's going to affect the ability of America to pursue its interests.